Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See, and I'm here in the studio with Stephen Thompson. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Linda.
Well, the weather outside is frightful.
It is. But not being at work this week is so delightful.
That's right. So we have a special show today for two reasons, one of which is that as you listen to this, we are concerned that we have spent part of this week snowed in. Mm-hmm. And also, as you listen to this, I am on vacation.
Yay!
Staycation, as we say. So we have a special show. We have two things that we're going to bring you this week that we're very excited about that we've kind of had on hold for an occasion just like this.
Clear in the vaults.
The first is going to be our interview with Fred Armisen from our live show that we had at the end of 2015. And then we're also going to have an interview that I did with the creators of Welcome to Night Vale.
Yay.
That we're going to be able to bring to you. So before we get to those two things, we have another announcement that we want to make, which is that our dear pal Barry Hardiman, who you may remember from her conversation with the author Robert Galbraith, a.k.a. J.K. Rowling, mm-hmm. is rolling into her next interview.
I see what you did there.
That's right. Her next interview with an author. Barry is going to talk to Matt Johnson, who is the author of Loving Day, a book that I am partway through and very much enjoying. Barry's going to be talking to him. So if you want to get started on that book, Loving Day, you will be ready then for Barry's conversation with him, which we expect to run sometime in February. So if you listened to our live show from Halloween, you heard some of what Fred Armisen did with us, but what you did not hear was the conversation that he and I had about some of his projects, including Documentary Now, a series on IFC that we liked a lot. So we're going to take a very quick break, and then we're going to come right back, and that will be me and Fred Armisen.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message come from TaxAct, the easy, fast, and affordable way to file federal and state tax returns. And TaxAct will guide you every step of the way. Start anywhere and finish anytime on your computer, tablet, or phone. If your deal is getting the best deal, go to taxact.com/pop and get simple federal and state returns free. TaxAct.com. You got this.
Our guest for this segment, Fred Armisen, has a resume as long as your arm, I like to say, if you have a very, very, very long arm. He is the kind of person for whom I actually look at notes because I am so afraid that I'm going to leave off something I intended to say when I wrote it because there are so many things. You probably know him from Saturday Night Live and Portlandia and hopefully from the recent series Documentary Now on IFC. If you have not seen that, you must seek it out immediately. He is the drummer and band leader for Late Night with Seth Meyers. You have seen him on Broad City and Parks and Recreation and Brooklyn Nine-Nine and Difficult People and Modern Family. He has been a voice on The Simpsons and Bob's Burgers, but also Grand Theft Auto 5. And that is a little tiny, tiny piece of the resume. We're incredibly excited to welcome Fred Armisen.
Hey, everybody. Hi. Thank you.
Well, I want to ask you first about Documentary Now, because I love it very much.
Uh-huh.
If you have not seen it, Documentary Now is a series that recently wrapped up on IFC. There were, seven episodes?
Really, it was supposed to be six,
one has two halves, right?
Yeah.
When I saw the first couple of episodes, it seemed like parody of documentaries almost.
Mm-hmm.
The first one that aired was Grey Gardens' Riff. It's great. But
Thank you.
As it went toward the end of the season, several of them got less that way and really seemed to be independent stories. And it wrapped up with a two-part piece called called Gentle and Soft, the story? The legend?
The something of
the Blue Jean Committee. Which is the Blue Jean Committee in this story is a California band of the
70s. Yeah, soft rock. Do you guys have satellite radio? There's a station called The Bridge, which is like 70s soft rock.
Right.
And it's the softest rock ever. And it's so soft that it becomes actually aggressive because the tempos are so just right in the middle,
right,
that there's a kind of anger to them. And there's so many harmonies, and I kept listening to it. So it's a little bit based on that music,
right,
and it's a little bit based on the Eagles documentary. So each of these episodes were a sort of tribute to a type of documentary, except for one, the one about the Al Capone Festival in Iceland.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
As you were kind of laying out the idea of that series, that trajectory was really interesting to me. Because by the time you get to the Blue Jean Committee, mm-hmm. the story of those two guys, played by you and Bill Hader,
uh-huh.
the story of those two guys in that band to have a sort of a rift, they make one album that's great that everyone loves, and then they have a rift. that's a very sad story in some ways.
But it's so common, you know, and really that was the sort of, that was a joke on the Eagles documentary, which you guys have to see. They're like working class Detroit guys, these Michigan guys, and they go to California and they make this really soft music, the Eagles, you know, and they run it like a business. So that was that. I mean, I don't think we really set out to make it that moving or anything. We really were in a rush when we made these. We're like, we got to do an Eagles one. We got to do a Grey Gardens. I was obsessed with doing this one Icelandic one, which originally, what it was, have you guys been to Europe, right? Come on, we're all travelers, right? Have I talked to you about flying yet? It is the worst. No. But they're obsessed with the blues and like the Blues Brothers and stuff. It's so weird to go to Germany and like the Blues Brothers. And the way that Europeans see Al Capone is, it really is what they love most about America.
Yeah.
So we just did a fake festival, a fake Al Capone festival in Iceland. So we built it. We had actors there and we did this pretend Al Capone festival. And it was the height of all my dreams come true. Yeah. Just to see that all, just to even be there, you know.
Do you think it's easier to have the kind of career that you have where you're doing a bunch of different shorter term projects, mm-hmm. right?
I would say, yeah, it is pretty easy to get it all going as long as you want to, you know.
How do you kind of screen the collaborations that you want to be part of, if that makes sense? Because it seems like what I always see you doing is being part of a whole bunch of really awesome teams.
Yeah.
More than like, this is my one big thing uh-huh. that's all about myself. And I'm wondering—
Well, except for Portlandia is all me. That's me. All the concepts, all the lines, all the camera angles. Right. That's all my design.
You play all the parts.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I've just always, everything I ever loved was groups. I've just always, is that the right grammar? Everything I always loved were groups. And so if I loved, for example, Kraftwerk or Talking Heads or The Clash, it was a group. Mm-hmm. That's what I liked most about it, with very individual points of view in the band. But that's why I always aspired to be in something like that.
Yeah. My favorite job of yours is that you're Seth Meyers' band leader.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't get to do it as often anymore.
Yeah.
But I do watch every night and give like notes and, you know, I really do. So I love it. I do it more like half of the time that I used to or something like that. But I love doing it whenever I can. I got a lot of the band members from D.C. Because, you know, the Washington, D.C., and I really mean it, it's the greatest local scene of 80s and 90s, without a doubt. It's the truth. Was there a better label than Discord? And I think Ian MacKay is everything that I always wanted to be, that so many musicians I know, so many labels I know, everyone wanted to be part of that scene. It was really the best, the greatest. So Seth Meyers, Seth is my friend, so I'll do anything. You know, that whole thing is like, I just like saying yes to things. I'm like, I didn't think about it. It was Lorne Michaels' idea. He was like, do you want to be the band leader and put together a band? And he said, curate. And I was like, absolutely. I didn't think the logic of it all. I would just rather try it. And then it's turned out to be a really good thing in my life.
Yeah.
I love it. It's really cool. And then we get to see great bands. We have guest musicians. So we'll have someone like Bob Mould on or something. And it's a dream. I like putting like old punks on TV.
Do you aspire to be an old punk on TV?
Yes. Yeah. I will always, no matter what, proudly be a punk more than anything. Like, it'll always be part of me. Everything I do, the original punk movement from London in 1977, and then here, and then Minneapolis will always be a huge part of me. Yeah.
What does that mean to you? Because saying like that you're punk means different things to different people,
but
right?
But mine is correct.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
I assume so. That's why I'm asking what it means to you. I'm trying to get the real definition.
I think anyone is allowed to say that they're part of the punk movement. I think that's what it is. Like, you could call yourself anything. I think it's allowed, you know? I just feel like I was always a punk fan. I'm still a punk fan. I played punk music. Just like people say that they're hippies or...
Right.
What else is there?
What are the other things?
Jazzos? What's jazz? I'm a jazzo.
Oh, nerd, they're saying.
Nerd? You could, yes.
That's another
absolutely.
One.
You could adopt that.
That's another one.
What's a country music one? A country bumpkin is not the same thing. That's...
It's a little different.
That's what other people say of other people.
Yeah.
Let's make these up now. A country head. right?
Country head?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a Captain Country. I don't know.
That sounds
good.
We'll
think of those later. Okay.
So what is, with all the stuff that you've already done, what is still on your list? I would love to...
I want to do a Spanish language TV show
that... Do you speak Spanish?
Yes. Sí, hablo español. Yo quiero hacer un show que en todo en español...
I figured you
pero
must.
Primeramente, I don't want to do it for like a specific audience. I want to do it for everybody.
Right.
In just the way that there's been some Korean pop music that's translated to here.
There has indeed.
Without having to be translated into English. So it would be really cool to see something that isn't all about being Latino or Spanish, you know what I mean? Where that's the theme.
Right.
That's in Spanish that has nothing to do with it. Would be really great. And then I just want to keep making things. I want to be prolific all the way through, right?
I think it's working.
Yeah, it's. But what's weird is it never feels like enough. Like
really?
Never. I understand this sounds crazy. I think I didn't do that thing yet, though. I didn't finish that. I got to do a show. So whatever that is.
Like, how will you know, though?
I don't know. But I'm not that insatiable that I will never appreciate. I mean, I feel very lucky, but I always have a feeling of like, I gotta do one more thing. One more, and then I'm good.
Wow, it is so nice to revisit that interview when I am not swimming with disease as I was when it actually happened. Uh-huh. So that was Linda's interview with Fred Armisen. Coming up next, we will have another Linda Holmes conversation that I was not at with Welcome to Night Vale's Joseph Fink and Jeffrey Craner. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. NPR Music's Tiny Desk isn't just any old office desk. It's become a stage for artists like Adele, John Legend, Sylvan Esso, Kacey Musgraves, The National, and of course, T-Pain without autotune. Now, if you're an undiscovered musician, you could play there too. Just submit a video to the Tiny Desk contest for a chance at stardom. Find out how to enter at npr.org/tinydeskcontest.
Please help me welcome Linda Holmes, Jeffrey Craner, and Joseph Fink to Six and I.
Hey guys.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm sure that you've done this 8 million times, and some of these people will know this already. Tell me what your show is.
We do a show called Welcome to Night Vale.
Right.
That is a fictional scripted podcast that takes the form of community radio from a small desert town where every conspiracy theory is true and people just get on with their lives.
And what is the origin story of your podcast?
Joseph and I met in 2009, and I'm a member of a theater company in New York called the New York Neo-Futurists. As well as Cecil is also a member of that company, and several of the people who've been on Night Vale are too. We met then and started just hanging out and talking. Joseph came to see our shows, and we would spend some time talking about writing and things like that, and so we decided to write a play together. In 2011 is when that was finally mounted. And we kind of developed this really nice collaborative writing system that we both got very comfortable with. So we wrote and performed this play, and in the process, we both talked about podcasts we love. We just both loved podcasts a lot, so a lot of our conversations would be like, let's work on the structure of the play. Oh, did you listen to Comedy Bang Bang? And we'd just start talking about these things. And that was it, and we just both liked writing together, so it became this thing of like, let's make a podcast, because we like working together, and we love podcasting. And I think a lot of it just came down to trying not to make a podcast that somebody else was already doing, because if they were already doing it, they were probably already better at it than we could be, so why copy that?
It's interesting because I think fiction is actually a relatively small segment in kind of current podcasts that you hear a lot about, right? Why do you think that is?
I think it's just sort of podcasting is still really new, and people more or less tend to do what they see other people doing in any new thing. And so for a while, podcasting was a lot of, I think at the beginning, it was mostly either public radio that was just sort of using it as an extension of their archives. Mm-hmm. And like tech people. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of the first wave, and then comedians sort of discovered it, and so podcasting became a lot of comedians chatting and comedians interviewing each other in this endless circle where everyone has interviewed everyone else at least once. There's definitely a good amount of fictional podcasts that came before us, Thrilling Adventure Hour, The Truth. Yeah. We blew up in this way that few fiction and podcasting had. And there was a while where I was like, it's interesting that this happened and no one else seems to be jumping on board, like there really hasn't. And then this year, it suddenly, apparently it just got delayed a little bit, that wave of fiction, because there's all sorts of new ones. One I really enjoy is the Black Tapes podcast. Yeah. Wow, it's the best response. It's a great show. It's these. I really am very fond of it because it's just like these two guys in Canada. I think one of them is like an elementary school teacher, and they just wrote this very like Serial in the X-Files world type show, and it's a lot of fun to listen to. And yeah, I have a great fondness for independent podcasting, especially independent podcasting that is doing something weird.
Yeah. You have a podcast that has built, as fiction, has built this like very complex world that these characters are living in. How bound do you feel to kind of any sort of continuity? Are you able to keep track of everything that you have said happens or the way that this place works?
From the get-go, we knew that we could sort of make Night Vale whatever we wanted to make it. That when Joseph wrote the pilot episode and we talked about the next few episodes that we would write, we just knew, like, this is a brand new world to us. It can be anything we want it to be, but we wanted to make sure that it did need to follow continuity. It did need to follow, like, the things need to matter. Things need to mean something. We always feel beholden to making sure that things make sense from time to time. I mean, I think definitely we have, it's storytelling, so, and it's an ongoing serial, so character who is in one place one time, we need to make sure that we know where they're at any given time. We don't have a show Bible the way like a TV show would,
right?
But it's just the two of us, so we don't have like writers coming and going from the writer's room.
But you remember everything.
I don't remember everything. I have search function for that.
Have you ever had a moment where one of you said, what if we did this? And there was a, but we already said that it works this way.
Oh, definitely. Yeah,
it
know.
It happens pretty regularly, I think. And it's almost always super minor stuff of just like, oh, that character, this happened to them, so we actually can't do
that
thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things I think is interesting about it is that the world building that's happening in the podcast is very similar in some ways to the really complex world building that happens in other parts of like sci-fi or horror or fantasy or whatever. But what struck me, and particularly it struck me when I was reading the book, is that a lot of world building has to do with the establishment of rules, right? You're laying out that those individual things that happen are, we're explaining to you how this world works. But in this world, a lot of the time it seems like that's not necessarily the case, it's just a thing. And I'm wondering how you feel about doing that kind of complex work where everything doesn't necessarily have, it's not part of a larger rule, it's not part of a larger scheme, it's just a thing that you like, that you think is either interesting or funny or whatever.
I think we very consciously approach Night Vale like not as a puzzle to be solved.
Right.
Because I think when you write weirdness as a puzzle to be solved, you make Lost. Mm-hmm. And then people get disappointed. I loved Lost. I watched every episode, but it was disappointing because there's no way to make weirdness a puzzle that is supposed to have an answer and not have the answer be disappointing. And so I think we really approach it as just, for the most part, this is just a weird place, and that weirdness is not something to be explained. That weirdness is just what it is. The real world's weird too, and we mostly don't know why.
So when you were making the show, so first you launch the show, you make it yourself. You put it up, you make it available. When do you know this is going to be a thing? This is going to be a thing that's going to devour a lot of my energy and life and time.
I mean, I don't think we knew until it was already a thing. There was nowhere a point where we're like, this is going to be a thing.
Right.
It was all past tense. I mean, because we, you know, we had a steady first year. It was very, you know, it was kind of mild growth. We were mentioned on the show called the NPR Pop Culture Happy Hour.
And you were indeed. That was not me, nice. But it did happen.
Yeah, thank you, Glenn. And that was a nice little bump. John Darnielle of the Mountain Goats mentioned us on his Twitter, and that was a nice little bump. But that first year, we had like 150,000 downloads, and that was way more than we thought we would ever get. July of 2013, we had 2.5 million downloads. And then in August, we had 8.5 million, just within August. And so it was all sort of retroactive in that we didn't really understand what was happening until about 2 months after it had happened.
Right. And what is your reaction then? At that point, do you think, is it like a dog that's chasing a squirrel that it finally catches it and it's like, what do I do now?
Well, I quit my job. The first thing I did.
No, the dog chasing the squirrel, like, it implies that the dog had the purpose of catching the squirrel, but we didn't actually know. It's like a dog suddenly just has a squirrel in its mouth. Just out of nowhere.
Again, sounds very Night Vale to me.
Yeah.
Dog suddenly has a squirrel in its mouth.
Yeah, it would just, we had no idea, because it was just a thing, and it still is a thing we just love to make, and it's a thing we love to make with kind of our small family of Night Vale people and actors and musicians and things, and it's a thing that even if we had never had that giant bump, even if we were still just hoping to break the iTunes top 200 list, that we would probably still be doing, because it was a lot of fun to write and to make and to build that world out. Yeah, it was just a learning experience, because suddenly we just found ourselves doing this as a full-time job. You know, fifth grade in 1985, I never had anyone at Career Day come and say, here's how to do a podcast. Like, that just never happened. And so that was just, it was a lot of just learning on the fly.
Yeah. When you start with something small and then it gets very, very big, particularly when you're working collaboratively, did you ever have any moments where, like, you had different ideas about the strategy for the show?
Not really, that I can think of. I mean, we've developed this process where, both I think with the writing and with business decisions, where it's just sort of, rather than be like, this is my position and this is your position, now let's decide who wins.
Right.
It's more like, here's your ideas, here's my ideas, let's use these to build something together. Mm-hmm. Which is both way more pleasant as a life strategy. It's just a better way of living. Mm-hmm. And it also, I think, generally comes up with better results. I mean, especially with writing, like, if you have two people trying to build something together rather than two people each trying to, like, run off in opposite directions, I think you just get a more cohesive thing.
Yeah. Because you have had to make a lot of decisions about how to support it and how to run it and how to grow it, because we were talking about the fact that you've got a live show tour going on right now at the same time as the book tour. Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty, it's a big operation. You have a lot going on. You have a lot of moving parts. As far as I know, the show has never had ads. Is that right?
No. Yeah, it's not a moral stand. Mm-hmm. We just never so far have needed to.
Right. Yeah. But you have membership, right?
Yeah.
Is that
right? We do membership.
So you work on membership and donations and stuff like that. This is partly just my own personal curiosity. Do you feel like that's sustainable? Do you feel comfortable with that model? And is that kind of where you guys want to be at right now?
I think so. I mean, it's been, you know, 2.5 years of kind of sustaining with that model. And so it has been good, right? It has managed to sustain the show. And especially the live show tours really is the big thing, too, because that's a... You know, doing these really large theaters and going and hitting all these other towns, and then, you know, it's an honest dollar. You know, you charge a ticket price, people come see your show, and then, you know, the actors get paid for that too. Well, and so there's this, so far it's been sustainable in that way of those like three areas of membership and merchandise and live show tours.
Yeah,
it's not a model that I would be like, this is a model that you can take and put on another podcast, because it's just this thing we stumbled into where it's managed to work. Mm-hmm. So in 2016, we're looking at launching some new non-Night Vale podcasts, and one of which is well on its way. There's like episodes that exist. It'll probably be launching in the early part of the year. And I think we're likely to put ads on those, just because we're not going to be able to do live shows. They're not going to have that initial donations. They're probably not going to have merch, at least, like, I can't guarantee, but it's like, it's just right off the bat, they're not going to have any of that, and I would like to be able to pay the people who are working really hard on them.
Yeah. What do you consider to be the themes of Night Vale? Like, if somebody said to you, yeah, it's conspiracy theories and are all true in a town, which is, I think, as good as you can get in terms of a capsule description, what do you consider it to, what do you feel like it's about for you?
I don't know. I feel like it changes, because it's you know, this continual writing enterprise that's just I'm constantly pouring words into. And I personally don't ever think like, oh, this is what Night Vale's about, and I'm straying too far from that. It's just my sort of feeling is, if I've written it and I can make it work in the language of Night Vale, then it fits. So I think like a lot of the themes, I guess, would just be interests that we have. And I know that, like, when I started writing the pilot of Night Vale, it was right after my dad had died. after years of knowing he was going to die at some point, but not knowing when. And I was having like anxiety attacks about death. And I think I put a lot of that into the show. So I think there's certainly a lot of existential stuff in Night Vale as a result of that. But again, that was just sort of a unconscious reflection of what I was preoccupied with that was just coming out that way.
Yeah. I want to talk to you a little bit about kind of tonal control, right? Because it's a show that is funny, but it's also a show that's creepy, and it's also a show that's dark. Do you ever write a joke that you think is too funny?
I wish.
You wish? All of them are. No one can handle them.
This joke is dangerous, dangerously funny. No, but you know what I mean. Like,
I do. I mean, I think it is always about striking that balance about, well, I think about it when I'm writing a script, similarly to what I would do in a social situation, right? Like if you find yourself with a group of friends and you find yourself being the one who's always like throwing the joke out or always cracking the quip into the middle of something, it can be very funny and people will laugh, but you do have to know when's your stopping point, right? Mm-hmm. Like when am I like making fun of some situation, or when am I making too much light of that? And I think I try and keep that in the podcast too. And then also, conversely, you do want a balance of levity and gravity. You do want to make sure that in a very heavy situation, it is always nice when somebody acknowledges, hey, this is really heavy right now, let's bring it back up. So for me, when I write Night Vale or anything, it is a matter of like always trying to strike those two balances. It's really fun to burrow deep into one area, whether it's horror or, you know, romance, or whether it's, you know, just existential academic whimsy or something. You have this moment where you want to bring it back a different way. And I'm always trying to like make sure that I land in a place that people aren't quite expecting. So that's where like jokes come in handy, or that's where like horror comes in handy in a funny situation.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the book, why this story? What was the appeal of this particular story? And how did you choose it out of all the directions you could have gone?
I think this story began a lot of the two main characters, Diane and Jackie, of both of us had these characters in our heads from a long time back. And it was, once we knew we were going to write a novel, and we knew because we were changing mediums, we were going out of podcasting, which is Cecil's voice, literally inside your ears through the earbuds, and that's not the way the novel works, right? You can buy the audiobook, Cecil does a great job on it, but it's still a novel, and there's no such thing as a 400-page radio show. And so we...
Good point.
Just wait. And... but we knew we needed to take, because it's an entirely different medium. We're not going to write it and as Cecil's voice. And also, if you want Cecil's story or his take on Night Vale, there's now 77 episodes devoted to that storyline. We knew with this first book we wanted to explore Night Vale, and we wanted to go inside the heads of people in Night Vale, and we wanted to send them to many different places, some familiar and some unfamiliar, just so I think people could, as they read the book, could actually put their feet on the ground in the town.
Right.
And see what it's like to be a citizen there, to be a single mother in Night Vale, to be a 19-year-old pawn shop owner in Night Vale, and to be inside those characters' heads. So it just, with those two characters, we knew right away that we needed to build a story for them and put them in this world.
One of the things that I thought was interesting when I read the book is that there are, I think it's true of the show too, but I noticed in the book, is that there are scary things in the book. There are kind of horror things in the book about bleeding and killing and being murdered by librarians, which I want to come back to what librarians did to you. But those things often pass with relatively little discussion of how scary they are. Mm-hmm. And the real horror element or the real fear seems to come from things in the book about identity, about people forget you, they forget that you existed, they forget that you were there, you forget who you are, you forget who somebody else is. Do you feel like identity is a running theme in the show beyond the book, or is it kind of specific to this story?
I mean, I notice it happening a bit in the show. I mean, it's definitely an element of, I think the idea of duality is a really, you know, or multiplicity is a really, can be a really terrifying concept. I mean, it could be used in comedy as well, but I think the idea of knowing who you are and why you're here is really that existential question of that we all face, which is we all know we're going to die, and it could be in any number of ways at any point in time. And I think that in accepting that, you then have to face the time that you have here, and that can be really terrifying. I mean, I think about that all the time in my own life of like, how long are you remembered after you're gone? How long, what impact do you make on the world? And so I think that that can be used a lot as a scary thing too. It's definitely something that comes up. I don't know if it's like a central theme of Night Vale, but it's something I play with a lot in my own writing, and it's appeared in the show quite a bit as well.
What do you have against librarians?
My first job out of college, my boss, we were at a board meeting, and she pointed out, she said, you know, the most powerful person in this room is not the president of the board or the chairman, it's the secretary, because they control what's written down, they control the information that's here. And I've always loved that thought about the person who controls the information is the person in charge. And I love that about librarians. You know, librarians do have a very powerful position, whether it's at a corporate archive or whether it's a school library or branch library or a major public library. You're controlling the books put out for people. This is what, so when you talk about a book not being available or books being available and how they are presented, that carries a lot of weight. So there is power in librarians, and it's fun to like amp that up to having like great black wings and hairy fangs and talons and spines, giant lizard-like spines. So yeah, whatever they look like.
It seems hostile, but I will take your word for it. I will take your word for it that it's not hostile. I want to talk to you a little bit about kind of podcast world. It does seem like, and this is a joke that I'm not the first person to make, but since the invention of podcasting by Serial, there has been kind of renewed interest in it and talk about it. But for you, who have been doing it for a lot longer, when you look around at what's going on right now, what do you see about podcast world that is interesting to you or concerning, either one or both?
Podcast world is my favorite theme park. Very. The Serial ride is weird, though. Yeah, I feel like we're still, like, I feel like we're still relative newcomers to podcasting. You know, there's people that have been podcasting since like 2004, and we, you know, when we started in 2012, I felt like I was coming to podcasting pretty late in that. But there's definitely been, you know, thanks to Serial, and also I think thanks to just people are starting to understand that podcasts make money, that it is possible to make money on a podcast. And as soon as you have something that makes money, suddenly you get people wanting to get that money. Yeah, I think podcasting is really exciting right now. I think there's a lot of really interesting new shows. There's a greater variety and a better quality of show now than I think there was 5 years ago. It's just, there's been this rush of new stuff, and a lot of it is really exciting. At the same time, you know, now HBO is producing the Bill Simmons podcast, and GE is producing a fiction podcast that's weird fiction, 20 to 30 minutes long. WNYC just started a $15 million podcast studio, and I worry about big money pouring into podcasting, not so much for ourselves. I think we've carved out our little space and we'll be okay. But I worry about people being able to do what we did of just, I have a weird idea and I have a $60 USB microphone and I'm gonna just make this thing and then maybe someone will listen to it. And I think that is what appealed to me about podcasting from the very start. And I really, really hope that all the money pouring into podcasting won't bury tiny, weird, independent podcasts like that.
Yeah.
What are you listening to right now that you really like?
The two shows, the only two shows that I'm completely current on that I've listened to every single episode is Criminal.
Oh, I love Criminal.
Criminal's the best.
So good.
And the Black Tapes podcast, because they hit a season break, so I'm just waiting for them to come back. But here's one that I think is the best work of podcasting that's been done in recent memory. I think it's truly something special that was done with podcasting, which is, you probably know the show, You Must Remember This.
Mm-hmm.
Did you listen to the Charles Manson?
I have not.
It is unbelievable. So You Must Remember This is this podcast about forgotten stories from Hollywood. And it's done by this woman, I think she's a journalist, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think she's like an entertainment journalist in LA that just started telling these stories. Again, I think it's just kind of her working on her own. And she did a 12-part series on Charles Manson that's incredible because she really takes a different angle on it than I've ever heard anyone do before. She doesn't tell the story the same way, that she doesn't just lay out the facts. She takes as her thesis statement this quote from Joan Didion about the Charles Manson murders that I don't remember exactly, but it was something like, the main thing I remember about hearing about it was how little I was surprised. And she really talks about the Charles Manson murder and within the context of the culture they took place, where they were not an aberration, they were inevitable. That the culture of free love had this poisonous misogyny within it. Those murders were a direct result of that culture. And she also does a lot of just exploring these amazing little side stories. Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys, the Manson family stayed at his house for a little while, and that's a very common part of the Manson story. Dennis Wilson was briefly friends with Charles Manson, but she then spends the rest of that episode exploring what that did to him, because when he found out who Charles Manson really was, when he found out what Manson had done, it destroyed him. It destroyed him for the rest of his life. He never really recovered. And so she then spends like a half an hour just talking about the rest of Dennis Wilson's life and what he did to try and recover from having befriended a monster.
I'm wearing a t-shirt of my absolute favorite podcast, which is The Read.
Oh, yes.
And I love it so much. And it is just two people with amazing chemistry that are so funny, and it is ostensibly an entertainment and advice show. However, I think they package in a way that is so easily listenable, so funny, so engaging, and you feel like these are my best two friends I've ever had living in my ears right now. But they pack in so much wonderful discussion about the politics around gender identity, sexuality, race. And I think there's so many important things being said on that podcast and packaged in a way that is truly fun to listen to. Does anybody here know The Worst Idea of All Time? Yeah, nice. Nice. The Worst Idea of All Time, I'll give you the quick summation. It was back in 2014, two guys from New Zealand. It's two dudes at a mic, but it's really amazing. And they decided to watch Grown Ups 2. Hang on. And they had not seen Grown Ups 1, and they decided to watch Grown Ups 2, and they watched it. They were going to watch it once a week, every week, for an entire year. And at the end of each viewing, they then do a 20 to 30 minute review of the film. And it's such a masterful use of experimentation in podcasting, because it becomes so little about the film and about just the deterioration of their friendship and lives.
It really destroys. It's amazing to listen to, because you are genuinely listening to people fall apart in a very real way.
It's so wonderful, and I loved, man, I plowed through that podcast. It was truly wonderful.
All right. Thank you so much, you guys.
You know, Stephen, the interesting thing about that conversation is that I don't think I have ever seen a crowd, even our crowd, anywhere near as excited about being at a podcast event as the people were about seeing the guys from Welcome to Night Vale. So I just want to thank Sixth and I and Politics and Prose, who organized that event and asked me to host it. And also, of course, Joseph Fink and Jeffrey Craner for being such lovely guests, and everybody who was at that event for being so enthusiastic. And when I say enthusiastic, I mean it. That was a great, great night. And I really appreciate the fact that they invited me. So that brings us to the end of our special Snow Day episode. We will be back next week with a regular episode with Stephen and Mia and Glenn and Kat Chow, our guest next week.
Talking Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
That's right, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. So if you want to catch up on that, you can catch up on that too. Thanks for, you know, coming in here to the studio with me, Stephen.
Thank you, Linda.
Take this very special episode. And thanks to our producer, Jessica Reedy. You can follow all of us on Twitter. I'm at NPR Monkey C, and Stephen's at I Dislike Stephen, and Jessica is at Jessica_Reedy. That's our official title now, I think. So we will be back next week with a regular episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. NPR Music's tiny desk isn't just any old office desk. It's become a stage for artists like Adele, John Legend, Sylvan Esso, Kacey Musgraves, The National, and of course, T-Pain without autotune. Now, if you're an undiscovered musician, you could play there too. Just submit a video to the Tiny Desk Contest for a chance at stardom. Find out how to enter at npr.org/tinydeskcontest.